Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. It has been a tumultuous few days for the Canadian federal election. Campaign as revelations regarding Liberal leader Justin Trudeau's use of blackface and brownface at three events in the past week. And while he has apologized for his racist behavior and attempted to explain his actions, this has dominated the news and sits at the forefront of many people's minds. It is fodder for the political pundits about the political repercussions. In addition, it has struck a nerve amongst Canadians and launched a discussion about racism in this country. And yet, there's still an election that is going on that's going to happen on October 21st. Here in Northumberland, Peterborough South, there are people out knocking on doors, putting up signs, holding events. In fact, my guest today just rushed in from giving an opening speech at the climate strike in Brighton, which I'm sure he'll want to talk about a bit later. I'm pleased to welcome Green Party candidate Jeff Wheeldon to the show today. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your assessment of the images of Justin Trudeau we have seen since Wednesday?
Well, I mean, I think most of us remember a time when that kind of thing didn't get a whole lot of comment, and that's really unfortunate. But it's possible for us to look back on previous eras and be able to recognize, even though we didn't think it was a big deal back then, we can recognize now that it did in fact hurt people, and that this is part of the culture and part of our cultural history. I mean, I was recently reading a book about Calixte Lavallée, who wrote O Canada. And I was surprised to find out that he was a Quebec nationalist, and the Canada he was talking about was not the Canada of English Canada, but also that his main career was as a blackface minstrel touring the U.S. So this has deep roots in Canada, and just because we didn't recognize it was wrong back then doesn't mean it wasn't wrong, and that we need to have a better conversation about how to move forward.
How has this changed the dynamic in terms of the national election in your mind?
Well, the dynamic of the election for the last 2 weeks has been mostly about character assassination or you know, just revelations about the character of different candidates. They've been very specific about targeting candidates. It's been going back and forth between Liberals and Conservatives. And the dominant narrative for the Liberal attack against Conservative candidates has been allegations of racism, homophobia, etc., and even just allegations that someone is friends with a known racist, such as Faith Goldie or something. So they were trading barbs about that back and forth. And so these revelations really will short-circuit that whole narrative because now Justin Trudeau is coming out looking the worst of all.
From the Green Party's perspective, then, does this make a difference for your chances?
I don't think so. I don't think that we're really trying to focus on this at all. I mean, we really have a comprehensive platform that we are trying so hard to get the word out about. You know, a lot of people still think that we're just an environmental party, or a lot of people don't understand just the grave situation we're in terms of climate change. So we really want to focus on building a better Canada. If that means that this is the election where we have a conversation about race, then we absolutely want to have that conversation. And I know for me, you know, as a straight, white, cisgendered Christian male, I'm not the best person to lead a discussion about diversity because I have so much to learn. I have, you know, Justin Trudeau talked about how his privilege has given him blind spots. I certainly have some of my own. And so my first job as someone who would want to be a leader through a time that's having this conversation means that I need to step back, find people who have a broader perspective on this and understand what it's like to be in oppressed categories. And listen to them, empower them, so that more people can hear their voices. And so we're no longer in a situation where these kinds of things can go by without comment or without sparking a firestorm of confusion and allegations and things that, you know, these revelations about Justin Trudeau have sparked more controversy than maybe they ought to. I mean, ideally, we would look at this and we would all say unequivocally, yeah, that was bad. Yeah, he really screwed up and should never have done that. But that's not actually the conversation we're having right now. We're still having a conversation about whether or not that actually was racist or something like that. So in terms of what I want to do in this conversation, I want to be very open to discussions about racism and how that affects people within our community. But I also want to say, look, we still have this entire platform that we need to talk about, because these conversations that we have over the next few weeks will determine the next 4 years and maybe the next lifetime.
Okay, and your comments, it's really interesting to listen to you speak, because on Wednesday, your party's leader, Elizabeth May, said in a tweet, "I'm deeply shocked by the racism shown in the photograph of Justin Trudeau. He must apologize for the harm done and commit to learning and appreciating the requirement to model social justice leadership at all levels of government. In this matter, he has failed." Now, listening to your comments and reading hers out loud, since then, Trudeau has apologized on two separate occasions and expressed deep remorse. Has he vindicated himself then in the manner suggested by yourself and your leader?
I think he's definitely taken some first steps toward that. It has been said a few times recently since these came out that Justin Trudeau has made a lot of apologies over the last 4 years, but that these ones seem to be the most personal and contrite, that he does legitimately seem to be sorry. At the same time, an apology is only worth as much action as it inspires. And so it's not always entirely clear exactly what action needs to happen after an issue of an error of judgment like this, and a deeply cultural issue such as racism, which is really ingrained not just in our culture, but in our systems. So there definitely needs to be a broader conversation about what exactly does action look like that would reduce racism in our personal biases and also in our social structures. And there are a lot of people who have been having that conversation and trying to have that conversation for a long time. There are academics who have done incredible research. There are advocacy groups. And so as far as that conversation goes, I want to defer to them and listen to them and say, what is it that Justin Trudeau should be doing? Because as just another white guy who wants to be a public leader or public figure, I need to be able to listen to them as well.
Do you forgive him?
I don't think it's up to me to forgive him. I think that it would be a really powerful moment to maybe see Jagmeet Singh talk about that. He gave an incredible response to just the allegations. He was in a press conference about something else, and somebody just told him or just brought this up. He hadn't seen the photo. And he was immediately able to talk about, from his own personal experience, just how harmful that is and how people are actually hurt by this. And I think that's something that we don't often take into account or give full credence to, the idea that racism isn't just, sticks and stones. Like, it really does hurt people. It affects the way that people see themselves. It affects the way that they see what they are capable of accomplishing. And so Jagmeet Singh is very conscious of that as the first federal party leader to wear a turban, or, as part of his religion. But at the same time, I feel like my role in this is mostly just to try and make sure that I am listening to the people who are racialized, who are discriminated against, and make sure that I'm not part of the problem and empower them to move us towards solutions.
Is this going to impact the local campaign?
I'm really not sure how it could, other than just a matter of... locally, we try and really focus on each other as candidates. I was just talking to Kim Rudd. She showed up to the climate strike I was just at. I didn't know she was coming. It was great to see her. There were a couple councillors there, too. And, Kim and I sometimes have coffee. I've met with some of the other candidates. The NDP candidate and I signed each other's papers to get our names on the ballots. Like, we try to have a very congenial campaign. And the difference between the federal or the national campaign and the local campaign always strikes me. Because we are able to have such a positive, engaged campaign here, and then you go on Twitter and you just can't believe what the national campaigns are saying about each other. And I think when people see that at the national campaign, they just feel sick. And when people show up to an all-candidates meeting, they see something completely different. And that's the kind of politics I want, is that positive engagement.
I don't know where you're hanging out on social media, but I'm going to ask about this because I look at, you know, I put up my show on social media and it's wonderful to see a discussion spark underneath, but I've seen other local posts go up and there's some real vitriol being posted by local people. I mean, so, you know, not just your usual, well, here's our policy and here's there and let's disagree. I mean, it gets pretty serious out there. What am I supposed to take away from that? Because that's been a little bit of my experience. I don't know. And you're saying it's not like that at the local level.
Well, I mean, I should say it's not like that in the in-person level. Okay. Social media is a terrible thing for our society. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. I've got an Instagram account that someone's thankfully running for me that I can be reached at least. But it's a format that really takes us outside of ourselves. It removes all of the filters that we would normally have when we talk to people face to face. And people are willing to say really terrible things on social media that they would never say to your face. So I try to remind myself of that every time I go on Twitter and I feel just exhausted by the really awful stuff on there. And then I go knock on a few doors and find out that the people who are behind these doors, my neighbors, aren't on Twitter. They're not following these things. They don't know about the latest allegations. They don't know about photos or anything like that. And so when you talk to people face to face, they just actually want to know what's up. And if they have followed anything, it's usually just, you know, picking up on the worst of the worst of the stuff that's out there. And so I'm trying to make sure that we keep it local and personal so that it's not just picking up that negativity from the national campaign.
Okay. We've mentioned now a couple of times, you just came from the global climate strike that was taking place today in Brighton. Can you tell us a bit about that event?
Sure. Global climate strikes were started last year by Greta Thunberg. She's a 16-year-old from Sweden. She started just going to sit outside of the Swedish parliament every Friday. She would just skip school and sit there with a sign that says "School Strike for Climate." Because she was very depressed when she would read the news and read scientific reports that say that we're headed toward a climate crisis and maybe a very bleak future for the next generation, and she saw a complete lack of action by leaders. And so she would just sit out there, and eventually she started to get a little bit of media attention, and now it's blown up to the point where there are millions of kids around the world who are striking today, and they have invited adults to join them as a general strike. Greta Thunberg has been apparently nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. She's spoken to parliaments around the world. She spoke to Congress the other day, and rather than giving some grand speech, she had very short, just a few sentences. She said, here's the IPCC climate report. This is what scientists tell us needs to happen. You should read it. And that's really the message that they're trying to get out. You know, they say, why should we go learn about science if our leaders don't even respect it enough to act upon it? Organizing that event in Brighton today was just a matter of wanting to make sure that people are still watching this, that our youth do have a platform, and that leaders are showing up and actually paying attention to it. Because it's all very well and good to make statements about your climate plan, or, you know, make statements about climate change in general and how we need to fight it. But if your actual plan doesn't have a target that leads or is consistent with a survivable planet, then what good is it? You know, climate change is one of these pivotal issues that affects absolutely everything else. I tell people that it affects everything from, you know, what kind of investments you can make into future markets, which are completely unclear right now, right down to how you flush your toilet. Because in Brighton, our sewage system uses a constructed wetland that won't function properly if it gets flooded out every year. So it affects absolutely everything. So if you don't have a viable plan for the climate, you don't have a viable plan for anything. And right now, there's only two parties out of the six running in Canada that actually have a climate plan that is aiming at 1.5 degrees or less.
You mentioned earlier, just to finish up that point, you mentioned earlier that you saw Kim Rudd there. Who else was there politically? Were the other parties?
No, the other parties weren't there. And I mean, it was organized fairly last minute. I was surprised that Kim actually was able to make it. There were a few councillors there from Brighton. We're working on getting some environmental advice to council in Brighton because they don't have a lot in the strategic plan there at a municipal level. But a few councillors were there, so that was exciting. Some Blue Dot Northumberland folks showed up. And there were students coming over from the high school. Unfortunately, I had to leave before they got there just so I could be here on time. But it's really about making sure that their voices are heard, because what we do today affects the world that they will inherit.
Well, let's talk more about climate and some of your policies. Now, the carbon tax has been a cornerstone of your party for a very long time. In fact, long before other parties began to adopt it. However, the Greens are saying they are going to increase the tax, and I think the timeline for the increase is different than the other parties. Is that correct?
That is correct. Now, the thing of a carbon tax is that it's only one part of a larger coordinated climate strategy. And so something that we've noticed is that all of the discussion about climate strategy for the last couple of years, since the Liberals started talking about a climate fee and dividend plan, has really focused on this carbon tax. And it's made big headlines provincially as well, with a number of provinces even taking it to court and things like that. But the reality is that it's just one part of the plan. Now, the goal with a carbon tax is to actually account for the cost of the pollution. You know, we pay for the fuel that goes into the car, and we don't pay for the pollution that comes out of it. That's called a market externality, and it really distorts the market. It makes oil and gas cheaper than it ought to be, and that makes it harder for new infrastructure and new technologies to compete. You know, we'd all be driving electric cars if we were actually paying the full cost of oil.
Okay, so let's just build on that then, because that sort of strikes me. So you charge this fee, then it becomes more expensive for me to get to my job.
Yes.
Which generates my money, which helps me pay for things. But then, you know, let's think about farmers and the increases of costs for them to do what they do. Now all of a sudden the food that I'm eating is costing me more. And all of these prices go up. How do you not get into an inflationary economy that all of a sudden everything's going through the roof because we're trying to pay for everything based on what you're talking about?
Right. So the economy of scale is important to note. There are some things like the cost of food would not significantly increase because, you know, the current carbon tax is actually far too low to actually make a significant difference in the cost of anything. So, you know, if we want to actually get people to a point where they're going to change their behavior and change the type of fuel that they're using, we need to make that sort of pain point at the pump a little bit higher. At the same time, what all of the detractors of the carbon tax continually deliberately leave out is that it is a carbon fee and dividend. You get that money back. So all of the money that is raised from the carbon tax, every Canadian gets an even portion of that as a dividend. It comes right back to us. So if you are using less fuel, you're still going to get the same portion of dividend. So if you're able to take that dividend and use it maybe to lower your overall costs by using less fuel, by maybe putting it into a car payment for an electric vehicle or something like that, you're still going to get that same dividend back, even though you're paying less into it at the pump. So in that sense, for a lot of people, they would actually be making money. And even with the Liberals' currently weak carbon tax rates, most people would still get back more than they put into it.
So let's just be really clear about that, because it's an important point. It's an important point that your party makes. It's an important point that the Liberals make, and that is this dividend. So if I spend $100 on gas, my dividend might come back at, what, $50? And then the government keeps the rest. I'm not sure about the proportions, but just the principle of it is I pay so much, I get so much back. And then you're saying that if I'm more green in my approach, if I don't use as much fuel, then I'll still get the $50, even though I may have only spent $40.
That's right. Yeah. So I mean, if you
instead of $100, yeah.
If you're putting $100 in your tank and I'm putting $20 into my tank, we're both going to get the same rebate.
$50.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so the difference between the Liberal plan and the Green plan is that the Liberals have a very low carbon tax rate that probably isn't going to affect whether or not I'm going to decide to make fewer trips in my car today. It's just enough to make me grumble at the pump. So the Greens would actually have a higher rate, but we would also return that dividend on a monthly basis rather than just once a year at tax time. Because for people who are depending on heating oil or something like that, like the whole point of having the dividend is that we want to make oil and gas more expensive, but we don't want to punish people who actually can't afford to upgrade. So that's the idea with the dividend. If it comes on a monthly basis, then it will help people to maintain their finances, but it's still going to change behavior.
Well, you know, when I look at the rest of your climate change plan, you guys are really big on sort of moving quickly and going forward in a very substantive way. For example, you're talking about reducing emissions by 60% below 2005 levels by 2030, which is basically 10, 11 years away, doubling Canada's current Paris Agreement targets. I also understand that you would ban fracking, you'd end the imports of foreign oil, you'd oppose new fossil fuel projects, and you also want to set up a bipartisan war cabinet to tackle climate change and end fossil fuel subsidies within a year.
Yeah.
You're also committed to closing down the Trans Mountain pipeline. So whether we like it or not, it sounds like you guys are going to do a lot of things. You're going to do them fairly quickly. And that has a lot of impact, big changes for everyday people on the front lines. So whether we like it or not, the oil industry is a major contributor to the country's economy. Aren't these actions in the end going to hurt us all?
Well, that's certainly the impression. And I mean, change is always difficult, even if it's a positive change. It takes a lot out of us. It's difficult to conceptualize when there's big changes that happen really quickly. But the reality is that the world is changing really quickly, whether we like it or not. And so it's a matter of which changes we're going to have, the ones that we can control or the ones that we can't. And so, you know, if we had acted back under the Kyoto Protocol 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we would not be in this position. If we had acted at any point between then and now, we wouldn't be in this position where we have to have fast change. But here's the thing. We do not set our targets and our timelines based on what we think is going to win us votes or what we think is convenient for Canadians. It's decidedly inconvenient, but it's what scientists say is needed for us to survive. And so our climate target, you said 60% below 2005 levels by 2030, is actually double what the Liberals and the Conservatives are planning. And it's still just a little bit over what scientists say is required to keep our planet to 1.5 degrees of warming or less. So we're doing the bare minimum, and it's twice as much as they've pledged to do, and they're only halfway towards their pledge.
Okay, fair enough. That all makes sense. But then, you know, if you go ahead and you impose all these changes, and it's going to affect the Alberta economy. It's going to isolate that province in our country. They're going to feel the majority of the pain. Aren't there political consequences to this as well, that you're going to have to mediate and you know, lots and lots of people? I mean, there's a University of Montreal survey, excuse me, that was done that breaks down the results by ridings, and it shows in our riding support for carbon-based fuel tax is 53% versus 41% opposed. What about those 41% people? I mean, drag them kicking and streaming, but, you know, you look at the county's recycling plan and there's lots of people upset about that. What, you know, it's, I feel like it's, you're telling voters, well, you're going to have to eat your vegetables, whether you like it or not. But it's a lot more severe than that, and I think people would kick up a much more of a storm. I'm just wondering how this stuff gets mediated. There's a political fallout. There's going to be a lot of individual fallout. Industries are going to have fallout. How do you guys balance all that out in the face of, you know, what you're saying is if we don't act now and we're doing the bare minimum, we're all going to be in deep trouble.
Yeah, and the hard part is communicating it, because, you know, this doesn't have to be an eat your vegetables thing. The reality is that, you know, and there's been numerous studies that have shown that this is actually a huge net gain economically if we do this. I mean, what we're talking about by transitioning off of oil and gas is we're talking about billions of dollars of government investment into Alberta to transition off of fossil fuels. Stanford economists have done a study that shows that Canada not only can get completely off of oil and gas by 2050, and it's possible with existing technology, but that we would have a net gain of 200,000 jobs. This is actually the greatest news of our generation, the greatest opportunity we've ever had. But communicating it in a way that that resonates with people when everyone else seems to be jumping on and saying, no, that's not possible. No, you're moving too fast. No, we need to go this other direction. We need to have more pipelines, things like that. The reality is that there is a far better economic case for shifting to renewables as quickly as possible than there is for producing more oil.
I want to come back and talk more about this. but I'm afraid we're going to have to take a commercial break. So I'm talking to Jeff Wheeldon, the Green Party candidate for Northumberland Peterborough South. Please stay tuned to consider this on Northumberland 89.7, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. My guests today are Jeff Wheeldon, the Green Party candidate for Northumberland Peterborough South, and we're talking about his platform for the upcoming federal election on October 21st. When you were talking earlier, you were making no apologies about your platform when it came to the loss of jobs, especially by the oil and gas sector. And I know that in your platform you're offering retraining, but at the same time, you're ripping apart people's lives. And as we've seen locally with the GM plant closure in Oshawa, it's fine when politicians talk about the future, but for those living the reality of job loss, it's incredibly difficult. How do you justify that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't wish job loss on anyone. And the oil and gas sector has taken a huge hit in Canada over the last several years without anything to do with transitioning off of fossil fuels. The oil economy is always volatile, and the Canadian oil economy faces certain challenges that make it more vulnerable to the volatility in the market. So, you know, it's not, I don't wish for anyone to lose their jobs, and people are also losing their jobs in that industry to automation. And right now we're looking at the possibility of a future over the next 20 to 30 years where 60% of all jobs that currently exist are going to disappear. That's enormous, and I haven't heard any of the other parties talking about that, and that frankly frightens me, because this is the biggest change aside from climate change. This is maybe the biggest change since the Industrial Revolution, and it's estimated to be four times the size of the original Industrial Revolution. And if you remember, you know, the original Industrial Revolution brought us Oliver Twist and Ebenezer Scrooge. It was a terrible time in Britain, where a lot of people were really oppressed or exploited. A ton of traditional industries disappeared, and there was just general upheaval, and it really created or exacerbated the class situation that really continues there to this day. But it was sort of the birth of this kind of exploitative capitalism that has led us to this climate crisis in the first place.
Well, precarious labor abounds in this riding. I mean, in fact, many people have to leave the area to find full-time work, or they need to have multiple jobs to earn a living. They often have to take a job where there's no benefits or a pension. What would your government do then to bring full-time employment to Northumberland Peterborough South?
Well, I think that what we're going to look at is changing the definition of full-time employment. So the Green Party advocates for a shorter work week. We advocate for job sharing because we're trying to prepare for a future where people have less actual labor. You know, it's supposed to be this wonderful idea that maybe robots can do some of our work for us. The idea that we are going to fight robots for increasingly low-skilled, low-wage, part-time jobs should terrify us. And yet, the only difference between that and a future where we don't have to work as much is policy.
But how's that different than a person that goes to work at a retail job here and gets paid minimum wage? They don't get more than 25 hours a week. They get the schedule constantly in flux. That's a short work week, isn't it? And yet people can't live on that kind of money. I mean, what are you talking about?
Well, we would have a guaranteed livable income that would ensure that everybody had their basic needs covered. And it would be set region by region based on the cost of living in that region, so that we could actually effectively eliminate poverty, at least from a supply perspective. And combining that with programs towards more affordable housing and things like that would be able to take care of people through the day-to-day as our economy transitions from one that depends on labor to one that increasingly doesn't. At the same time, we would pay for that by things like, currently the information economy, which is the biggest part of the economy, data is worth more than oil at this point, is unregulated and untaxed. And so we would look at taxing Facebook, Google, Netflix, all of these things that are generating a ton of revenue, and none of it is coming back to the people who, frankly, it is our engagement with these platforms that generates their money for them.
But the moment you tax those things, they flip around and that just gets passed on to us, and it costs us more money to do that. And again, we get into that inflationary cycle. How do you avoid that?
Well, the thing with the information economy is that we're not paying for any of these services. They are making their money off of us. We are the product in social media. And so, if we are charging them a fair share of that tax or a fair share of their profits, that can't come back to bite us without completely changing their user model or their business model. And frankly, maybe their business model needs to change in a way that is less exploitative of our entire society.
How's your party going to balance the budget in 5 years with all the spending that you're proposing? Now, you've mentioned a couple of the initiatives, but one of the things I notice is that you haven't put your budget before the Parliamentary Budget Office for costing. Why is that?
We have, actually. It is before the Parliamentary Budget Office right now.
Because I checked this morning and there's nothing up.
Yes, it hasn't come back from them yet.
Okay.
It was sent in to them quite a while ago, but we've always sent it to the PBO. We asked them to do it, and now this is the first year when they have offered it to all political parties. And everyone has taken them up on it, actually, except for the Liberals who brought in that program in the first place. They've said, well, we're only going to send some of our stuff to the PBO. Now, the Conservatives have said that they're going to get an independent auditor to look at it because they seem to distrust the Parliamentary Budget Office. But either way, we always like to be the first one to get ours vetted, and we really are always pleased to have not only a full platform and a full slate of candidates, but a fully costed budget.
Let's take a moment and talk a bit about yourself. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. I'm 35 years old. I am married. I have two children, little boys, 5 and 2, and we live in Brighton. I work as a real estate agent in Brighton. And I really enjoy that work, not only because I enjoy helping people to, actually make one of the biggest decisions of their lives in buying a home, and making sure that they understand the entire process, because there's a lot of little things involved and legal implications and economic implications. And so, they put a lot of trust in me, and I really hold that trust as sacred. But also I enjoy the work because it has a very flexible schedule, and that means I can spend more time at home with my boys, or that I can spend more time talking to lovely folks like you.
Do you remember the moment when you became passionate about politics?
I do, actually. I was sitting in Assiniboine Park reading a book under a tree. We had just moved to Manitoba, and I had been getting more politically aware for a little while, and I had always had a bit of an environmental streak. And so we had just moved into Manitoba, and we were sitting in a park, and I was reading a book called Losing Confidence by Elizabeth May. And I had just a vague notion of who Elizabeth was, but her book is about how our political structures, our systems, were set up in such a way as to have particular functions in our society. And over time, that's shifted. Over time, there's been more concentration of power in party leaders, more concentration of power in the prime minister's office. The prime minister's office used to be the prime minister and a secretary. Now there's over 100 people who work there, and very few of them are elected. So this idea that our systems have shifted in ways that actually make them less productive and efficient, make them more partisan and divisive, concentrate more power in the hands of fewer people with less accountability, and that has led us to a situation where most of our politics is nasty and people are disengaging. And how can we ever have a forward-thinking, visionary leadership when everyone's focused on just dragging down everyone else? And so at that moment, I thought, I can't just be somebody who is interested in this stuff. If I want to make a difference, it doesn't matter if I knock on 1 million doors and, do everything right in my own life. If I really want to make a difference, there's going to be a policy barrier at some point. Because, if we don't have policies that allow people to make progressive changes in our society, then we're always going to come up against these limits. And we've seen so many groups that are campaigning for change, whether it's trying to address systemic racism in our society, as we were talking about earlier, trying to address environmental issues when the government's still sending billions of dollars to oil and gas companies. Those kinds of things impede progress. And so it takes having progressive visionary leadership that is not going to try and exploit the system for the sake of power.
So the event that you were at earlier, just before here, with the high school students coming over and this climate strike that so many young people are getting involved in, does that impact your vision that you've just talked about? Does it make you feel more hopeful that it's not going to always be about character assassination and bureaucracies, but more about policies and people?
It does and it doesn't. It makes me hopeful because I see really positive things happening in grassroots. But it actually makes me much more pessimistic when I compare it to the actual official political campaign, which is just so much worse by comparison. You know, you've got these hopeful kids who have good priorities, who respect the authority of science, who are trying to work together to start something, you know, and that makes my heart sing. And then I turn around and look at the latest allegations on Twitter, and I just, my heart sinks.
Well, tell you what, Jeff, remember this moment, because I'm going to tell you something. I think, just me spitballing here, but I think these young people that are getting involved are the beginning of what was be the same as the peace movement in the 60s. And I think we're going to have these climate kids that are going to come out, and it's going to be a generational change, just like it was for the peace movement. So let's see who's right.
Okay. Well, I sure hope so, because, you know, the peace movement and the green movement go back a long ways together, and I want to see that happen.
Well, you watch these young people take off. I think it's going to be a real wave. But we'll see. I don't know the future, so who knows. I know at one point you were a minister. Is that correct?
Well, I have 2 degrees in Christian theology. I got my master's degree in systematic theology back when we lived in Manitoba. I've never actually held an official ministerial position. I was always getting more education. I've done internships and things like that. My wife was an ordained minister.
So do you support abortion?
I do not. Or, well, I do support abortion. I am pro-choice, but that was a difficult position to come to given my upbringing. You know, I came up, the first political event I ever remember was as a child standing outside of a hospital with a sign. That was the culture I was brought up in. And so it took a lot of actually considering the issue and all of the practical implications of it. You know, I didn't know for all the years that I was a pro-lifer that it was actually before abortion was legalized. There were networks of clergy who were sneaking women out to Mexico to get abortions because of the incredible damage that the prohibition on abortion was causing. You know, there's so many of those kinds of details and the practical implications that are really overwhelming. Any politician who tells you that they would try and ban abortion either doesn't understand the legal context and framework that we exist in here in Canada, or they're just trying to get your vote with it.
If you were invited to the Gay Pride Parade in Cobourg, would you go?
I would absolutely go, and I would love to go. What I don't want to do is show up and try and make myself the star of the show. The Pride is not about me. I am a straight, cisgendered male, and so that it's not my parade. I want to go as a show of support rather than as a photo op for a politician, because we've seen an awful lot of that lately, too.
In the last election, your party won 2,000 votes. In 2011, your party won 2,500 votes under redistribution. In 2008 was your best election in the old Northumberland Quinte West riding, with nearly 5,000 votes and about 8% of the total votes. With all the talk about the Green Party breaking through, do you think locally you will beat that 8%?
I think so. We're polling at, nationally, we're polling at about between 10 and 12%, depending on the poll. And locally, we're polling just, you know, about 0.5% better than the typical national average. So I take that as an encouragement that maybe I've made a difference here. But I think that we can continue to grow. I think that there is a critical mass that people look for when they vote. You know, typically, Green support is much higher the week before the poll, or the week before the election, than it is on election day, because people are, you know, at the last minute, they often decide, oh, I don't want to waste my vote. And, you know, we always tell people, well, the only wasted vote is the one you don't believe in. And if you only ever vote for, if you only ever vote against something, you'll never actually get what you want. But people are starting to see that Greens actually are electable. They're starting to see that that there's growth. I mean, we've got 17 Greens across the country elected at different levels of government. So there's a lot of growth happening there. And a lot of times, also, people are starting to feel like it is a wasted vote to vote strategically. I mean, a lot of people lent the Liberals their vote back in 2015, in large part because they were talking about proportional representation. And people thought, well, if I just vote Liberal just this one time, then next time it'll be a different voting system and I can vote how my heart really wants. And then we were let down. And that was a crushing blow. You know, even though I ran as a Green in 2015 and I lost, I felt pretty good after hearing Justin Trudeau's promises on electoral reform, on environmental issues. And then over the last 4 years, it's just been one blow after another as he's walked away from those key promises that really won him a lot of the green vote.
Let's talk more about strategic voting, because I know that's a big thing for our riding. I mean, let's be honest, for the last couple of decades, it's been really a race between the Liberals and the Conservatives. And if you feel strongly about not wanting to let the other party win, then, how do you justify voting for the Greens?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Most of the time when people are concerned about strategic voting, it's because they talk about there being a split vote on the left. The Conservatives do have a really strong party structure. They do get their supporters to continue to support them and to show up to vote. And so it's up to the other parties to they don't have just as strong of a base. Sometimes NDPers are willing to go to the Liberals or the Greens, and sometimes they jump back and forth between these parties. But the reality is that there are a lot of perspectives within the Green Party platform that do appeal to traditional conservative voters. And I say traditional conservative because current conservatives, it's not your granddad's PC party. They took the progressive out of the progressive conservatives a while back, and they no longer really support a lot of fiscal sustainability. And I say fiscal sustainability because the word fiscal conservatism has come to be synonymous with just cutting programs, slashing and burning, as we've seen provincially. The Green Party is about fiscal sustainability. We want our economy to be able to continue on in 50 years and continue to grow stronger, not to just cut everything with the hopes that we can balance the books right now. So that appeals to a lot of people who maybe used to carry PC cards and have either gone Liberal for the last number of elections or have just not voted. And typically where Greens get elected, it's where we've increased the vote. We've brought out the people who gave up on the system a while back. Now, the other thing that I say to people is if you're concerned about splitting the vote on the left and maybe getting a conservative government as a result, if that's your fear, then you should go out and find a conservative voter and convince them to vote Green to cancel out your Green vote, not going to the Liberals. And then you can both vote Green in good conscience, because I think once people hear about us, they're usually pretty happy to support us, but it takes the work of going out and connecting with people one-on-one to make that happen.
You know, you were being critical at a moment about the Conservatives and them cutting programs, but I mean, you have a very ambitious platform yourselves, and there's lots and lots of costs, and I guess shortly we'll hear from the Parliamentary Budget Office to know just exactly what that's going to be. If you were put in that position, would you cut programs? Would your party cut programs, and what programs would they cut?
Well, we're really concerned about the whole idea that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So there are strategic investments that if we make them now, they will save us money hand over fist in the long run. I was at a lecture from Ralph Torrey recently. He's a climate scientist. He ran in that more successful Green campaign a number of years ago that you were talking about. He's doing some analysis that looks at how if we were to invest strategically in getting off of fossil fuels, having a strong renewable energy economy, how the upfront costs seem fairly significant, but within about 5 years, we're actually just making money because we're saving so much when it comes to energy, the cost of energy production, energy efficiency, and some of the other changes we want to make that would also boost the economy in terms of better transportation infrastructure, public transit, those kinds of things actually help our economy to grow in a healthy and sustainable way. So, it's very much short-term pain for long-term major gain.
Your party's slogan is not left, not right, forward together. Are you really centrists, or because you guys seem really extreme when it comes to the environment?
A lot of times we get painted as being leftists. On the CBC Vote Compass, we come out as further left than the NDP, which probably drives them nuts. But because they like to call us Tories on bikes or Tories who recycle. But the reality is that our policies don't fit very easily into those categories. We have we tend to prefer market mechanisms, which aligns us more with a conservative perspective. But we're also, really strong on social justice, which aligns us more with a more leftist perspective. And so we don't actually fit those categories very well. But mostly what we're trying to say here, we're not trying to say that we're centrists, or even just that we're all over the map, but that we are trying to reduce partisanship. Because when we go back and forth over and over again between the red team and the blue team, you know, whoever we throw out, then their replacement comes in and spends the next 2 years just cutting everything the last guys did. And when we start from scratch and we just keep, you know, this yo-yo between red and blue is killing us. We don't have time for messing around. We don't have the resources to waste in starting and stopping programs and projects all the time. You know, that you mentioned earlier that we would have an all-party war cabinet. The idea with that is just that if we were to form government, we don't want it to be just Greens who are making decisions, because we want everyone to be invested in it so something can last beyond 4 years.
Jeff, I can't believe our time's up. I'm sure we could go for another hour or two talking about stuff. So thank you so much for coming in and spending some time with us. And I really appreciate the fact that you had the event before here and you raced down to be part of this interview. So thank you so much for making all that extra effort.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, I will have the new Democratic Party candidate Mallory McDonald coming in, and I'm looking forward to that interview. As part of the coverage of the federal election, Northumberland 89.7 FM and Consider This are teaming up to help you get your questions and concerns addressed by the candidates. So we're asking you to please send us your questions for the candidates. We will collect them and send them off to the candidates' campaign teams to get answers. We will then post those questions and answers to our websites. That means that if you have a question or a concern you want addressed by a candidate, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can post to my Facebook page or send it through Twitter. There will also be a feature on my website that will allow you to submit a question. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves about this show, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page at considerthis. Or if you are on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read a selection of the comments on next week's show. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you'll find my past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to listen, and I hope over the next week you will continue to consider this.